Hello and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Jelena Golubovic, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with anthropologist Larisa Jašarević about her new book, Health and Wealth on the Bosnian Market, Intimate Debt. This was published by Indiana University Press last year in 2017. So Larisa, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks much, Jelena, for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
So this book is all about the odd ways that the body and the economy, or health and wealth, as the title goes, are interrelated in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And you write in your book that this topic wasn't quite determined in advance, but was really formed through your engagement with the field. So could you tell us a little bit about the initial stages of your fieldwork and how you came to see this relationship between health and wealth that would become the subject of your book?
Right. So I started off being really interested in political economy as an anthropologist, right? So cultural economies, consumption and circulation. And in a sense, it made all the sense for me to start there because Bosnia after the war has exploded in markets in all guises. So I started off by just really looking at circulation, being interested in the kind of debt that I was seeing circulating, or the ways in which economy debt had very little form of financial instruments was circulating, and little capital, or let's say strange sources, unpredictable sources of capital, how it was managing to circulate goods. So I started off with that, and you know, I went to marketplaces, flea markets, street markets, produce markets, shop boutiques, pharmacies. I mean, you just saw corner stores, later on supermarkets and so forth. And then little by little, just started paying attention to the various kinds of complaints that at first I just thought were very random. So people would comment on the shortage of customers or on the fact that the debts were appreciating, that the sales were low, and would immediately switch to the language of bodily ailments. So, or else would just comment on, for instance, on very poor sales, but then would follow with the comment, oh, but for as long as there is health. Like, the health is the greatest wealth. So thank goodness, oftentimes, the God would be wrong. Thank goodness that there is health. So there was something, there was anxiety, basically, was one thing I started hearing. The anxiety with which the wealth, or the lack of wealth, was being dismissed in favor of appreciating the good health. And of course, anxiety about all kinds of gluts in the circulation of the capital and the goods and so forth. And so at first, I heard this, and I just sort of, you know, it wasn't very ethnographic of me, but I was downplaying it, you know, just kind of dismissing it, like, ah, this is just the way that people are saying things. But by and by, I just started sitting in with these complaints. And I should say that I should actually say that this goes back to my pre-dissertation work. This goes back to the inquiries I was doing while I was doing the research for my master's thesis, which basically concerned the same phenomena and was concerned or was traveling, exploring the same sides of the market. So by the time I went back to the field as a PhD student, I think my ethnographic sensibilities have sharpened a bit, and by that time I have actually caught up on medical anthropology and on phenomenology, anthropology of the senses and so forth. So it really, I should say that I was rather thick when I started off, you know, and that the political economy I was really interested in, which is a fascinating field, especially the way anthropologists are treating it, I think. You know, what we make out of commodities and money and capital and gift and debt and so forth is very rich. I mean, economic anthropologists are doing a very fine job and are just exploring the depths of these presumably ordinary market instruments. But, you know, paying attention to the bodily, to the sensual, to the visceral complaints, and to the anxieties that wasn't just, you know, in people's heads. So it wasn't just the way that people speak about things. You know, it wasn't something that I could explain by foregrounding the common sense and the tangibility of the market instruments. That is, I think, what made the whole work more honest. And ultimately, I can hope that it made the ethnography sort of richer.
Yeah, there's a vignette close to the beginning of your book that I think really wonderfully sets up what is to follow and how these fields are so interrelated. You talk about how you're speaking to a woman who works at the market, and you ask her how business is going, and she responds by opening her purse and pulling out a handful of medicine to show you, and she says, "This is how business is going."
Yep. Yeah, that was one of the key moments in the field work. And you know something, I mean, and this is a great vignette, of course, you know, something that an ethnographer would hope for. But I think that, again, you know, I was so thick. I'm actually hoping that I'm not as thick these days. But, you know, I really feel, looking back at the field experience, I feel like it just took me so long. What that gesture did was to, I think, to ask me to be more brazen. Because again, you know, so it's so easy to look at the gesture and to say, oh, this is just the way that people speak. This is just a way of describing an anxiety, which is really about something else. But no, what she was actually saying is that the business was disturbing her bodily flows. You know, so what she was logging in and out of her books, her body was registering her blood pressure, her blood sugar. She was literally embodying the flow through her pockets and through accounts and through her shelves and so forth. And I think once you take that seriously, then it required me basically to take a second look at what is body. What is the body? If really it can register economy, if it can register the debt or the capital flows and outflows, what is the body? You know, what a strange materiality is that? You know, so that little by little I started estranging the body and taking the vernacular sense of how these domains intersect, taking it very seriously to actually pursue the local etiology. You know, how a disease comes about, how is body affected, and ultimately to think through the bodily materiality and surfaces as sort of extended out into the world and therefore vulnerable. And being extended into the world, being extended to the world of things, again, materiality that is capacious, that is interacting. So, you know, estranging the materiality of the body, thinking it as extended into the world, having these vulnerable and highly potent and responsive surfaces require me to actually then think more expansively about the matter, the commodities, you know, instruments, the debt ledgers and so forth.
So as you mentioned, Bosnia is a post-war state. You're mentioning new markets sort of cropping up after the war. And also it's a post-socialist state. So it has this new market economy. And one of the chapters in your book, I think the first one, it sets up sort of this struggle of surviving in this new post-socialist, post-war economy against the memories of Yugoslav socialism, where people, particularly urban people, had grown very much accustomed to living a comfortable life. So I'd love to ask you a bit about how this history of socialism, together with the history of the war, which was to come in the 90s, continues to inform people's relationships about what it means to live a good life, or as you put it in the book, to live beautifully.
Yeah, so the reason why I'm pausing in answering the question is that things are changing so rapidly. You know, the economy itself is changing, as is the sense of the good life. So what I was writing about, I think, was fairly true and up to date for about a decade after the war, and even about 5 years ago or so. And then I've noticed, I mean, I am noticing, I'm constantly in touch with the field. I do research every summer, and then last year I spent a whole year in the field doing a different research altogether. So I am, you know, I keep my finger on the pulse of this place to the extent that I can, you know, ethnographically, and things, the sense of the good life has changed quite a bit in the last 5 years. So this is why I'm hesitating. But the moment that I was describing was really the moment when sort of the war scarcity was still in a very fresh memory. And then against that, there was this, once again, the explosion of the market that happened after 95 and then at the turn of the millennium and even up to 2007, up to 2010. And it was just such an expansion of the market opportunities, you know, opportunities to actually make money, to buy, to purchase beautiful things, to refurnish the apartments, to dress your children well, to sort of pick up from where many people basically felt they got interrupted by the war and so forth. And so it was an interesting moment also because the old sense that, and I think very much the socialist educated sensibility about what is quality, what is goodness, what is to be appreciated, was sort of coming up to terms with the proliferation of the aesthetics and the qualities that were coming in with the new neoliberal kinds of values and commodities and so forth. And one way to think about this, if this is too abstract, is through clothing, something that any Bosnians very much appreciate. I mean, clothing is something people get seriously invested in. And the sense of the quality that came through the socialism had to do with durability, had to do with natural fabrics, had to do with kind of styles that were going to be classic and that are going to last. And so much memory was invested in the various pieces. I write about this, various pieces of clothing. The clothing was basically also an index of a particular time in or it was a biographical, to put it simply, it was a biographical kind of index. So a very potent kind of a token of a time lived and time shared and so forth. And so that sense of what the quality is, what one ought to invest in, was sort of coming against these proliferation of rather cheap, right, commodities. Everyone was commenting on the cheapness and the styles that were just ephemeral. Of course, you know, this is the classic description of neoliberal goods. Styles are very short-lived and very fast to change and so forth. But this was one way in which people were sort of negotiating the values, the values of the good life, of looking well, and looking well also had to do not just with social standing and with the incomes, but also had to do with health. You know, how well composed you are is also speaking to how well you are, how is your health. So I just saw many negotiations at this point in time. On one hand, you know, you can really think about it as kind of a strange meeting of two economic sensibilities or political economic sensibilities, right? Because the 1990s did something very strange, well, not strange, but they were kind of an interlude, right? So that when Bosnians emerged out of the war, they were plugged into a very changed kind of a global economy. Right, without having, because being preoccupied with the war and so forth, and subsistence economy and recycling and so forth, you know, without having realized that, that the world has changed significantly. So there was, through these consumption habits of the everyday life, one could really see a certain kind of historical, what is it, historical stuttering, you know, to sort of invoke Bourdieu, kind of a sense of a habitus getting accustomed to a changed milieu, right? A habitus sort of being raised with different expectations, being accustomed to a particular circumstances, and then being thrown into a different historical or political economic circumstances, and then just sort of stuttering, you know. So this is so one way to think about this is also another vignette I have in the book is that I walked with one of my very, very dear interlocutors into a flower shop, and you know, flower shops were trying to stay in business, so they were selling all kinds of things because flowers weren't exactly the most lucrative commodities to circulate. And so there were all kinds of things in there. And then she looks at, there were stockings, among other things, among the pots and so forth, there were stockings. And she looked at them and she gasped. They were kind of pretty, pretty stockings. And then she gasped and then she said, "Oh no, I would never buy a pair of stockings if they were in a flower shop." You know, so this is the kind of it's such an interesting kind of a registering of a covetous commodity, right? Something that is beautiful and that is, you know, that is desired. And of course, we're talking about someone who is living on the budget, right? But also someone who has been very used to looking well and who has been composing her wardrobe very carefully and through all kinds of, you know, ups and downs of Yugoslav economy as well, was negotiating, you know, keeping a well-composed wardrobe and so forth. And all of a sudden now, is walking into, you know, walking into a store and registering a sort of all kinds of ambivalence, but also discomfort, and also registering that things are sort of out of joint. That, but also, you know, this is telling because, you know, it shows us what the commodity is. A commodity is far more than just obviously the use value. But it has to do with the proper milieu, right? It has to do with the shopping experience and so forth. I'm not sure if had I actually answered your question at all. I'm kind of detouring.
Yes, no, I remember this woman from the book. I remember that vignette and also you pointing out that this same woman had bought a pair of green leather gloves that were also located in they weren't in a glove store. They were in some other market space where it was a bit incongruous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this, of course, has to do with the ways in which the inconsistencies, which are part of making do, you know, inventing as you live your everyday life, trying to make the best possible affair, right, under the strenuous circumstances and so forth. So people make all kinds of compromises and these expectations are sort of changed and switched. And so she did it for the sake of her daughter, which makes all the difference, you know. So for the sake of her daughter and making a perfect match between the boots and the leather gloves, the color, the hue, perfect hue match. I mean, she disregarded the fact that it was in supermarket and as a matter of fact, she hid them at the bottom of the pile because the money wasn't really readily coming along. So she was going to, she was hoping to hide them until she would come up with the sum of money needed to buy them.
You mentioned that in the past 5 years or so, the idea of the good life has changed. How do you think it's changed in the past 5 years that is sort of not fitting in with the way you had described it in your book?
You know, I mean, it's a slightly difficult question because I'm still coming to terms with it. I'm really trying to put it into words. I mean, one thing that has definitely changed is just the massive out migration. I mean, you had Bosnians, of course, migrating during the war, after the war, so many refugees and then post-war migrants and so forth. But then the economic out-migration in the last 5 years, I think, has been stunning. And what we have with the out-migration is also repatriation of not just the remittances, right, the capital, the investment and so forth, but repatriation of styles, of expectations, because you have diaspora traveling back and forth, visiting during the summer, during the holidays, investing in the land, in the houses, outfits and so forth, and a sort of setting up certain kinds of expectations as to what the good life now is. And I'm kind of thinking at these days through two issues. One has to do with land, because I'm actually thinking about herbal medicine a lot these days, and apiculture, beekeeping, and gardens in general. So you can definitely see that the aesthetics of keeping it a garden and keeping the house have changed much. And this is very important. This is not just the way that the yard is now looking, that, you know, that now you have the perfectly mowed lawns, and that you have park ornamental trees as opposed to the fruit trees and so forth. It's not just that the looks of the yards and houses are changing, but also the whole relationship with what the land is and what it does. And this, of course, has to do with health, because so much of the healthcare, popular healthcare, is reliant on so-called natural medicine, природная medicina, on herbal medicine and so forth. So in this sense, you know, that relationship with the land is actually changing on the one hand. But I'm actually also thinking about so the out-migration, right, the back and forth of the people and ideas about what kind of a life should be pursued, mm-hmm, ideally, but also relationship with land. And now I'm thinking about health. You know, I'm trying to think. I think if one thing is still constant, is the sense that the good life has to do with the well-being, and that well-being actually has to do with a certain kind of closest to nature. Uh-huh. And people often talk about the return to nature, or povrata k prirodi, or in any case, are talking about natural things, prirodno. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And there's a great value invested in prirodno things, and natural things. So the homegrown, the homestead, indigenous kinds of fruits, wild things, weeds, mushrooms, and so forth. So I think, you know, on one hand, you know, I'm struggling quite a bit to put this into words, because this is a part of something I'm just observing, and I'm only just putting into words. But I think that there is a change in expectations, a change in the senses of what qualities ought to be pursued. But on the other hand, also the sense that ultimately, the quality of life has to do with health, and that health has to do with cultivation of certain kinds of ties with the land and access to these potent natural substances. And so what's interesting is that you have quite a few health migrants among the diaspora. A lot of people actually come back, and I write about this as well, the healers that I describe in my book. Many of them are actually treating the diaspora, like the Bosnians who are working on foreign markets, so actually living elsewhere but are coming for the summer and so forth. Many of them are actually coming to see local therapists, alternative healers, Quranic healers, Strava healers, herbalists as well, imams. Many of them are seeking Quranic medicine and so forth, you know. So and as well as seeking these the natural products that supposedly can be found in Bosnia and are richer and are actually helping soothe the ailments of the foreign lived lives, right? So there's the expectation that the diaspora goes out there and finds rich labor markets and finds income opportunities which are missing in Bosnia. And, you know, their wealth amassed is quite obvious, you know, it's put on display. But at the same time, they're suffering it. They're suffering long labor hours. They're suffering all kinds of things. And so, you know, they're repatriating their complaints and seeking the health remedies here in Bosnia. So in that sense, I'm sorry, I'm detouring here as I'm trying to answer the question, but I'm also just kind of thinking afresh, thinking aloud through these differences, but also continuities, you know, about the good life and the health, which is integral part of it.
There is one healer that is featured in the book, and you call her the queen. Everybody, I guess, calls her the queen. This would be a good time to ask you to just describe for the readers, who is the queen and why do people go to seek her out and how do they seek her out? And another interesting component, I think, is how do they attempt to repay her for healing them?
Yes, so the queen. The queen starts and ends the book. And the queen was really one of the key figures, obviously, that my fieldwork evolved around. And then the years after, it took me a while to write this book. So the years after I was part of the pilgrimage, seeking out the queen and enjoying her company. You know, healers are usually, anthropologists, medical anthropologists are going to tell you, are usually very enigmatic, very puzzling characters. And so was the queen. I mean, she is mind-boggling. There's no getting down to the bottom line of figuring out who the queen is. She's very, very influential. People seek her out from across former Yugoslavia, Bosnia, across the whole diasporic Bosnian community. People of all profiles, of all ethnic ethnic age groups, all classes, whoever has got a health complaint, especially a stubborn health complaint that they've been paddling around and have not found a cure for, they end up at Queen's doors. And she treats with means that are, on one hand, simple to watch. She moves her hands through the air at a distance from the patient's body. Sometimes she treats them while they're sitting in the waiting room. Sometimes they lie down on the couch, examination couch, and she just dances her hands about their bodies. And oftentimes joking and talking something completely different, joking a lot, but also switching moods very rapidly. So she could go from joking and being very cordial or sweet and tender to someone to being very harsh and inquisitive, critical, for various reasons. So she would, you know, so it's all along, she's gliding her hands among the above the patient's body, and they're reporting all kinds of sensations in their bodies. She's also treating people with her eyes only, with gazes. And I write about this. I try and think through this, the mechanics of this therapeutic reach, if you will. She's also treating people on distance, at a distance, via Facebook at a time, over the phone, with SMSs and so forth. And interestingly, she is disassociating herself from all of the all of the medical styles, if you will, all of the established therapies, because there are many different alternative therapies. There is bioenergy, which is kind of similar, sort of the sense that people are healing or working with these vital forces, one's own, that can be recuperated and targeted, focused on the patient's body and so forth. But she will have nothing to do with bioenergy. She is very dismissive of Quranic healers and so forth. So she's disassociating herself with all of these various categories, and she's actually conversant with biomedicine. She's reading oftentimes the anatomy atlases and books, and is commenting on how comparable and how different, yet how different her perceiving and knowing the patient's body is. So do you want to direct me in any, is there anything particular before I just sort of...
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point that, I mean, in your book, you don't really privilege these alternative medicine approaches nor biomedicine. And I found it really interesting that the queen more aligned herself with the biomedical regime, and she would sometimes refer people even to doctors to confirm her diagnoses. And so is it fair to say that the people in her waiting room, the people who are seeking her out, they're not leaving necessarily the biomedical field? They're sort of using these two approaches in this complementary way.
Absolutely. I mean, people are actually using all sorts of approaches. Very, very rarely will someone just completely turn their back to the biomedical institutions and devote themselves to a healer. And most healers are actually recommending that they combine. So a Strava therapist, another type of traditional therapist, will actually also direct people to see a doctor, or a physician will actually send one of her patients to see a Strava therapist as well. So there is a, even though there is a formal kind of a modernist sense about discrete categories, you know, you have the healer and the cure on one hand, and you have a medical doctor, or you have a medical doctor and then charlatan, right, as its opposite. On one hand, there is that. It's a formal kind of a sense of what is real and what really works and what is efficacious and so forth. But in the practical realm, you actually you see practices mixing all the time and across the board. So the queen actually is sending people to the doctors. Many of her patients are medical doctors, professionals, from surgeons to nurses. And they will refer her. She actually also claims to have been involved in medical procedures, so that she was helping out the doctors see through a particular procedure, or pointing to the ailment or something that they, the source of the discomfort that they could not detect with their diagnostic technologies. So there's that, but she's also being very fickle, as she is. She's often very dismissive of them, you know, of their incompetence, of their greed as well. There's quite a bit of critique of the medical economy in Bosnia for various reasons. Some of them are very justified. But so she can be dismissive of their professional incompetence, professional arrogance, sorry, or of the greed, tendency to charge patients under the table. Mm-hmm. She quotes for various procedures and so forth. And she's also, so sometimes she would be sending patients to the Strava therapist. These are therapists, these are usually women therapists who are treating with lead, mostly anxiety-related disorders. And so treating people with lead, water, and chronic sores. This is what I mean by Strava therapist. But oftentimes she would basically be very suspicious of most of them. So yes, on one hand, absolutely, this complementarity is something to really relish as an anthropologist. Because it's showing the vernacular kind of pragmatic approach to what body is and what health and ailment are, you know, and it's very experimental. It's much about, you know, testing out these various trials. And of course, much of this has to do with the fact that biomedicine, former biomedical kind of clinical practice, has lost quite a bit of its authority. On one hand, during the war and after the war, because people have registered the sense that the bodies have changed historically, that the bodies are being material domains, are also subject to historical change, and the bodies have altered through the war and after the war, and that new kinds of ailments and new kinds of sensibilities have come about that biomedicine is simply not competent to treat with. And so on one hand, this kind of skepticism or this kind of seeing, popular seeing that there are limits to biomedical kind of authority, competence and knowledge and expertise have opened up the access to all kinds of old and new practices. So some of these Quranic healing has a very, very long tradition here, as does the Strava healing and so forth, herbalism and so forth. On the other hand, the biomedical competence has come into question because of this new kind of post-war privatization of medical healthcare. And this is a familiar story to medical anthropologists around the post-socialist world. But also this informal market, like black market economy in the clinical services and so forth. So all of this has sort of eroded the kind of the much of the socialist pedagogies about, you know, the modern way of treating the body and modern definition of health and illness and so forth. So I think this complementarity, the sense of the vernacular experimentalism, you know, that the putting to trial so many claims with, you know, this is a sort of a vernacular form of symmetry that is being recommended to us as social scientists these days. You know, treat the claims with equal kind of attention, with due seriousness, without a prior assumption as to what is valid, what is proven, what is evidence, what is the nature of evidence, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You discuss how people that seek out the queen, they're not necessarily relying on lab results to know that she's effective. There are sort of other clues that let them know that she will provide an effect. And one of them is that she doesn't advertise and she doesn't have a price per se. She's paid through gifts. I'd love if you could speak a little bit about this system. I think it's related to, you were saying earlier, the Queen's critique of the sort of the greed of doctors in accepting bribes and accepting payment for the services that they're providing, whereas she's paid, but in this more indirect way.
Yeah, this is a really good question. And brings us back to the beginning, sort of the ways I sort of found out gradually these very vital, very tangible similarities, connections between the health and wealth, the medicine and the market, right? The body and the financial instruments. Because there is a sense in there's a sense that the good healer is known by the fact that they don't charge any money, right? And so this is sort of this is a traditional wisdom. And much of this, again, has to do with Islamic healing traditions, both the Quranic sort of healing through the inscriptions and recitations of Quran, but also the Strava, you know, the more the folk and more sort of the kinds of therapeutic practices that have been traditionally practiced by women in particular, but also reliant on Islamic tradition. There is a common sense here that it is improper to ask for money, and that the genuine healing is actually the gift and can only be practiced as such. And this kind of common sense actually expanded into the moral economy of the clinical centers as well. So there would be a sense that the real doctor would actually not ask for any price, for any additional fee, would not ask for money, but would necessarily be gifted, right? So in the even you know, the socialism, there was a sort of a need to gift a doctor who has done you a favor, who has treated you well. So there's a sense in which, and oftentimes the healers themselves who are seeing patients first, particularly Strava healers, are going to urge the patients who are ailing and exhibiting various kinds of symptoms and complaints, are going to ask them to exercise generosity. So this is a part of the curing repertoire. I mean, you take the inscriptions, you take herbal teas and swell, but you also practice generosity. This is a part of the advice, the health advice, prescription that the traditional healer gives you. So the gift is there for various reasons, having to do with all of these things I said, but at the start of it, a sense that, you know, healing touch is a gift. All of that is qualifying. Or it's just basically describing the requirements for a good healer, that are helping people seek the cure. And people are embarking on these very complicated intersecting trajectories as they're trying to find a cure, a treatment. And so, you know, looking for a person who does not advertise and therefore is not just modest, but is so efficacious that the word spreads, right? So that other people are recommending him or her to the patients, new patients. So that recruitment is actually, you know, by the word of the mouth. And the word of the mouth is, you know, think of it, is a trial. I mean, this is the evidence. I recommend the healer because he has helped me in such and such a way, or has helped the neighbor or the son of the neighbor, and so forth. You know, so there are all of these genealogies of the past effort and the complaints and how they were resolved. So this is part of, and this is one way in which Queen is doing her best to distinguish herself from other healers. And just like the market is proliferating in goods and services, so is the health market proliferating after the war. If I hadn't made this clear, I should have had. Right. So in this complicated market, with all kinds of claims, and many of them inflated, and many of them such that have been disappointed, right, or that people have been disappointed in this market, the Queen and others are setting themselves apart by stepping outside of the profit-making economy or even income-making economy and relying, falling back on the gift. And the Queen does that in such interesting... Have we got the time? Should I say a little more about this? I don't know how we're doing the time.
That, yeah.
Am I talking too much?
No,
with Queen, it becomes... every healer, it's kind of complicated, but with the Queen in particular, because she, as a person, as a healer, she just wields this tremendous amount of power, right? And because she's fickle, she's changing, and people would actually like her to like them. Like, there is a sort of a vying for attention, which is therapeutic, but also just sort of cherished. You know, the Queen likes you, and that is something that it's not easy to achieve. So because she's wielding so much power, people are overwhelmed, and this is therapeutically desirable and efficacious. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of crushing. It's kind of again overwhelming. And then they register her indifference to money. So what can they do? How do you repay someone who is really turning your life about? You have a serious problem, seriously unwell, or someone you love dearly is unwell and no one else has been able to help them. And so here is this Queen, and you've seen the progress, and yet you don't know how she's treating you. One day she's going to scream at you and complain and critique your style of dress or your hairstyle or something like that, or your everyday habits, finding them faulty, finding them very much related to what ails you and so forth. Another time she's very tender and soft and so forth. So how do you, and you cannot repay her, right? So people are, so it becomes very, of course, every gift ends up being also a debt. It creates a debt and is possibly a poison, right? Because it's cumbersome. It weighs down on the receiver, especially, you know, if the sense of the generosity and reciprocity is sort of deeply embodied. It's only proper to give back. And if you don't give back, it's sort of, it hurts. You're anxious about it. So this was a sort of a game that I was watching at the Queen's play, sort of the kind of the inability for people to pay her back because she has done so much for them and because she cares, not for money. And, you know, however much they give, it's going to be too little and it's not going to register. And then also if they give too much, oftentimes she's going to refuse the money. There is no even guarantee that your money is going to be received. So you know, ends up being, on one hand, for me, it was a great commentary. The gift economy at her clinic and the gift economy at other clinics, other therapeutic was just really a great, insight into the political economy proper, right? The other marketplaces. Am I answering your question at all?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think the gift economy was a really interesting element and the point you make about how people are actually creating this wealth through debt, through being indebted, and then they feel a compulsion to give and to give well, to repay, and it's for them creating this positive effect in their life. I do have, if we have time, one final question for you, because listeners that are familiar with the literature on Bosnia will have realized by now that your book is very different from the vast majority of research on Bosnia and on the former Yugoslavia more generally, in that it's not concerned primarily with ethnic division and identity politics and reconciliation. But there is this very interesting political element to your work that comes through in your concept of circumstantial communities, sort of the communities that that get formed through many of the examples you listed at the Queen's waiting room and other health initiatives. And I'd love if you could sort of elaborate on that concept for us.
Yes, thank you. Thanks so much for bringing it up. Because I haven't really mentioned it up to now, but the sense of the political was kind of a, or the idea of the political was something that I was careful to craft through the book, and I thought it was important and even perhaps necessary, because it would have been impossible for me to write a book that was entirely about economy and medicine and just completely silent on the question of the former politics and so forth. So in a sense, I had to pay some respect to the otherwise very present issue, you know, the ethnopolitical kind of a framework within which people are pursuing the health or market opportunities. And so one way for me to do it was, again, not stepping outside of the market or in the clinical settings, and to appreciate the real efficacy, the kind of mattering that emerges from the sides of the market and from the sides of the healing and curing and so forth. And what I was trying to basically say is that these things, these issues that are very much on people's minds in everyday life, are actually important in their own right. You know, they're not sort of, they're not secondary, you know, because oftentimes the tendency of scholarship on Bosnia, for very good reasons, is to favor and to foreground the ethnopolitical situation, for obvious reasons. And then everything else gets to be relegated to the background. And even if there is a pursuit of everyday things, still because of the ethno-national political issues are foregrounded, everything in everyday life ends up speaking ultimately to the ethno-political situation. Right. And so, and I wanted to step away with that from that because this is not what I was seeing. By foregrounding the questions that I thought were the dearest to people I worked with, you know, the health and wealth, was actually making me appreciate that these issues are primary concerns and they're mobilizing people's interest and times. People are investing in them. And through these practices, medical and market, they were generating, exercising all kinds of real efficacious influences and powers. And these issues actually were so vitally important that they were gathering people around them, you know, gathering around the, in the market, around the complaints, in the clinics, but also around these sites of extreme suffering, of a tragic accident, the news about a car crash, a car accident, a suicide, obituaries that are posted around the town, that oftentimes, towns, and oftentimes occasion these group readings and commenting. So all of these, I thought, were actually creating or exercising, bringing out, bringing about the experiential kinds of communities, the communities of shared experiences, you know. And I was thinking through this as a kind of the political gathering, right, and the political potential, which is very different than the politics kind of reduced to the voting and seat holding and power sharing and so forth, but rather the political that has to do with the good life, political has to do with the potential for these circumstantial communities to come about around the shared concern and do something about it, right? Share the complaints, share the feeling, and through that exercise, on one hand, empathy. But on the other hand, I mean, you can think of it in so many different ways, compose or exhibit, you know, that kind of a community and vitality that can be mobilized at a time, but cannot be recruited for any kind of a formal, again, ethno-national kind of narrow-minded or narrow-focused kind of goal. And I think this is, of course, I was thinking these experiential communities and the sense of the political here, I was thinking through with Jean-Luc Nancy, someone I've been thinking with throughout the book. And I think this is rather important, and not least to the, you know, proper political anthropologists of Bosnia who, you know, have been observing the last several years these sparks of political effervescence or of collective kind of gathering and dispersing that are very brief and short-lived and oftentimes not very well recruited for any long-term kinds of solutions and so forth, but that are there in potential and are actualized in these particular places, right, that are grounded in everyday sites and everyday concerns. So this is something I was trying, and this again has to do with something I said earlier when you mentioned that scene when the trader opened up her purse and took out the medicine. You know, when I ask her how's the market going, how are sales, taking the experience seriously. And as I was commenting at that point, you know, that, you know, taking that experience that she was describing seriously made me think through the bodily materiality and the materiality of the, you know, commodities and capital and so forth. But likewise, you know, taking the collective experience seriously, the collective experience of the market or of the medicine, the collective experience of reading obituaries together, you know, and exercising this collective, very strong empathy that, again, disturbs people, you know, disturbs people quite seriously, so that some of them take tranquilizers after that or dread about the possibility of the premature death and so forth. So just taking that experience very seriously and not just dismissing it, saying, oh, you know, this is just, it's fleeting, it doesn't concretize into anything particular, it basically doesn't matter. But no, taking this seriously is something that I think has a great deal of potential for us thinking more expansively about politics in general, and politics in Bosnia in particular, you know, just so that we get out of the rut of the ethno-national everything, ethno-national politics, you know, full stop, bottom line. Does that answer your question, I hope?
Yeah, that's great. That's such a refreshing contribution. So thank you for that. And thank you for putting aside the time to come on the show today.
Not at all, Yelena. Thank you so much for inviting me and for reading my book. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
So that was Larisa Jašarević talking to us about her book, Health and Wealth on the Bosnian Market, Intimate Debt.